Martin keeps saying over and over again, nobody's talking about lab leak, nobody's talking about this gain of function and whatever. Why don't you discuss it? And so just briefly, I wanted to bring this up, that in my view, the lab leak theory is two sides of the same coin. You know, you have some people mostly on the right of the US and people like Richard Dearlove in the UK who are trying to insinuate that it was a mistaken lab leak or a deliberate lab leak from China and trying to point the accusing finger at China. And then you have others like Martin Summers himself and maybe you know, people on the far left who are saying, no, this is a war on China. Basically, that's a to and fro. He says, she says, you know, you can't get to the bottom of that sort of a dichotomy. And it's not a clear, you know, it's not a clear narrative at all. There's hardly any evidence for that theory that it's a lab leak. Because if it was a bioweapon, that's what people are thinking, that it's a bioweapon, why is the infection fatality rate so low? Why is it equivalent to the flu? And why doesn't it affect certain countries? Why didn't it affect countries that took no action and basically did not lock down and did not make a fuss about it? Why didn't it affect them if it was a bio leak?
Well, I think some of them were affected. And, you know, I mean, there are all sorts of degrees of bioweapon. I mean, obviously, this isn't the plague or anthrax, and it could be simply a kind of economic bioweapon designed to wipe out pensioners who are taking money without producing, you know, revenue for governments and, you know, taxable income for banks or whatever.
Well, yes. So I think bioweapon is a slightly misleading terminology, because it gives the impression that it's actually something that physically exists. What I am coming to the conclusion of is that it's a psychological weapon, not a bioweapon or a real novel virus. And the evidence of that is gradually emerging over time. So the infection fatality rate over various studies, a German seroprevalence study that was conducted in the early phases of the pandemic in a high prevalence region of Germany called Heinsberg, the study came to the conclusion that the overall average infection fatality rate was 0.41%. Further studies by other teams led to the results of analyzing meta-analyses came to an average of around 0.68%. And, you know, the highly acclaimed Ioannidis' meta-analysis came to somewhere between 0.02% for those who have the least risk and 0.86% those that have the highest risk. And the median of that was 0.2. So that is what has been going on for the last 20 months, basically, is that the median infection fatality rate is around 0.2% or 0.4%. That's not a pandemic, and it's not a bio warfare in the terms of a weapon like anthrax or so on. So that's what I was basically going to say. There's really no evidence of that. However, there may be a asymmetric warfare, and that's another discussion. And I also think accusations that it was a leak from a wet market is also unsubstantiated, because insignificant numbers of people visited the wet market and created the initial infection, which, you know, there's no explanation of how that then transmitted across the world. So the question about why did Wuhan lock down, which is what Martin keeps saying is that China reacted as if it was reacting to a bioweapon. I think you can also look at it from other points of view. Wuhan actually had one of the biggest protests in China in the summer of 2019. And that has been reported in both BBC and Reuters and Al Jazeera. You can find it online if you search for Wuhan protest 2019. On the 28th of June 2019, apparently over tens of thousands of people protested for up to 3 days against the building of massive incinerators close to the residential area just on the outskirts of the city of Wuhan. People have been protesting in China over the course of many years about air quality. Air quality is a major issue in urbanized Chinese cities because they're so massive. China, Wuhan has a population of about 10 million. And if they have, you know, incinerators of waste disposal incinerators, as well as the, you know, coal-fired power plants and so on, the air quality is going to be extremely poor. And it's already known. I mean, it's widely known that the air quality in China's major cities are quite poor compared to European cities, let's say. And so, again, you know, the reason the government or the regional government, local government reacted by looking down at the sign of sort of a pneumonia type lung infection could be that they were trying to prevent, you know, a repeat scenario of what had just happened no more than 6 months prior in the summer, especially at the time when China was conducting the, you know, they had the international military games and there were other things going on in Wuhan at the time. You know, so having a massive tens of thousands of people protesting in China or in the city of Wuhan about air quality, about and also about health treatment, because that is also a major issue in China, that people, you know, it's not a communist system in the sense that they have a free healthcare at the point of need. They have to pay for much of their healthcare. So, you know, it's a struggle for people if they're suffering from lung conditions, which is exacerbated by the air quality. So I just think that's a potential other way of looking at why Wuhan was the city that locked down so aggressively. And so that basically brings me to my point of view about what this thing really is. And, you know, I think this it's pretty clear that this pandemic was planned. It's been planned for well over 10 years, possibly 15 to 20 years. I, you know, they've war gamed this several times. I believe the swine flu was a sort of a war game, a simulation, because the facts don't add up on swine flu, as Dr. Wodarg has explained over and over again, that it was a pharma-driven narrative, the swine flu one. The bird flu one, again, was also a bit of a wet flop. It didn't turn into a pandemic. The Ebola one, you know, was a very localized thing. It didn't blow up despite the narrative, the mainstream fear porn that was trying to generate a sort of panic over an Ebola type pandemic. So I suspect those were in a way a type of war game or simulation, along with tabletop conferences and consultations that they do, whereby they iron out the issues. And so we've seen those tabletop exercises, famously the most recent one, which was, you know, the exercise 201, But there have been other ones, Lockstep and Signet, I think, and various others that have been done over the years. So that they get to the point where, and this is where COVID-19 pandemic comes in, they've ironed out all the kinks. And in their mind, they believe they're good to go with a pandemic that will really blow the socks off all previous pandemics or pandemic narratives. And everything that the Rockefeller Lockstep pandemic simulation document, everything that was outlined there is pretty much what has been unfolding in the last 20 months. So, you know, I feel like that this is what COVID-19 is to usher in a biosecurity state. They've decided to jump on this whatever it is that was causing a few deaths in China. And then, you know, they basically push this fear narrative so that any region that had deaths basically assumed that it would be COVID-19 deaths. There was no treatment allowed, that treatment was prohibited or hindered, and that, you know, they've just somehow managed to keep this narrative going. And in order to do that, they've done several things. And I mentioned already the first thing they did, which was 10, 11 years ago when they changed the definitions of pandemic. So I've explained already twice how pandemic definitions were changed. They've also changed the definition of herd immunity. So let me just bring that up. The definition of herd immunity was changed in November of last year. So previously, if you looked at the World Health Organization on the 9th of June, or let's say in this is the image I have from the 9th of June in 2020, the definition of herd immunity is protection from an infectious disease that happens when a population is immune either through vaccination or immunity developed through previous infection. So bear that in mind. It's a two-pronged thing. You either get it from vaccination or you get it through immunity to previous infection. By November 2020, WHO had rewritten this definition. So the definition for herd immunity now is this. It says, it is a concept used for vaccination. Herd immunity, also known as population immunity, is a concept used for vaccination, in which a population can be protected from a certain virus if a threshold of vaccination is reached. Herd immunity is achieved by protecting people from a virus, not by exposing them to it. That's almost diametrically opposed to the first definition. And, you know, it's a most bizarre definition, even for a layperson such as myself. The next definition that they have altered, which is available or was seen on the CDC website, the first definition was taken. The image was taken from May 2018. So this is a definition of what vaccine means. What is vaccine immunization? Now, they've changed the meaning of that because vaccines have changed. So the new gene-based or cell-based injections, the mRNA and the DNA vector vaccines, are not, as people keep saying, not traditional vaccines. So they had to change the meaning of vaccine, which they have done. And it's by September of this year, it was changed. So previously, the definition meant a vaccine which is introduced into the body to produce immunity to a specific disease. The new definition is this: introducing a vaccine into the body to produce protection from a specific disease. And so the two things, to produce immunity versus to produce protection, you know, you might think that's a slight difference, but immunity is a specific thing. If you're immune to something, that means, you know, you're not going to get it, right? For as long as you live, probably, on the most part, you're not going to get it, which is the standard theory associated with childhood vaccines. You know, once you've had them as a child, you no longer need to receive them, apart from maybe another booster some 10 or 20 years later.
We're talking itself here about things like potentially like polio, or I mean, these, you know, the old vaccines from ancient times, it seems like now, you know, such as the cowpox to inoculate you against smallpox. This is something that you only need to do once you've caught, right, if you want to put it that way, the vaccine. Your body is then absolutely prepared for this disease, whenever it comes along. It really doesn't stand a chance in your body. What you're saying is, now a vaccine, all it does is it gives you protection of some sort against, well, it might be just one variant of a particular disease, and it might not actually stop you catching it or transmitting it or anything. Right. You know, so it does seem like they've really dissolved down what a vaccine is and what it can achieve.
Yes, and you know, in the definition, it kind of explains how this new vaccine works. Instead of it stimulating a person's immune system to produce immunity, which is what traditional ones were meant to do in theory, the new ones are basically, it says, and it's a very clever change of wording, it basically says, a preparation that is used to stimulate the body's immune response against disease. So it's taken away the actual specificity of saying stimulating the body's immunity to produce immunity. You know, so literally it's removed that. They've taken that away. The fact that they're not describing them as giving you immunity anymore.
Well, I mean, as I understand it from history, I mean, you know, we need, I think, to keep focused on Edward Jenner and his extremely dubious experiments on people, where he would give them the cowpox without them necessarily even knowing what was going on. I mean, but the thing is, the result of this was enormously successful. So the idea here is that you're giving somebody a similar illness to a potentially fatal illness, so that you're almost kind of training the body's immune system to be prepared for it. And then we also had different newer types of vaccines, which were somehow denuded or killed version of the same virus that were then put into people's bodies. Right. And that was another way. But this, it seems to me, is a completely different way of doing things, where you're tricking the body's cells into producing the toxic parts of the virus. And the idea is that here there's some sort of benefit through your body then attacking those. But, you know, this is a completely different way of doing things, by getting your cells to produce something which your body will then attack. There's an immediate potential danger there of some kind of autoimmune disease, either straight away or somewhere down the line.
Of course. And as I say, even a lay person can understand that sort of theory and concept. And, you know, when they're challenged on this, the whole narrative just kind of crumbles. It's built on sand. You know, there's no logic, there's no scientific rigor behind these new pronouncements. So I saw a brief clip of Andrew Marr interviewing a lady on Sunday morning, just gone. I can't remember who she is, somebody from the higher levels of the NHS, I suspect. But he was asking, he was sort of grilling her. He was asking her, you know, where are all these hundreds of thousands of cases that we were being, you know, that were being mentioned earlier in the year, that, you know, there was a real danger that, you know, we would have a surge of new infections and, you know, the fourth wave or whatever it was. Where are all these cases? And she couldn't really explain. And then he said, and who exactly is dying, you know, according to the statistics? And she literally said, it's all the same people that have been dying for the past 20 months, i.e. elderly people with critical health conditions or, you know, other serious comorbidities. So she said that flat out. And then he said, but that's, you know, I find that confusing, because aren't they the ones who have been vaccinated, most of them double vaccinated? And aren't they, you know, didn't they have a very high compliance rate? So, you know, high numbers, let's say in the 90 percentile have been vaccinated. And what was her response? Her response was, well, you know, older people have weaker immune systems, and their immunity, you know, that they develop from the vaccine doesn't last as long. So she came out with a new terminology: immunity waning. What the heck is that? You know, they're coming out with new made up words that have no basis in scientific fact.
Well, maybe it just means that the vaccines aren't working, but they don't want to admit it.
Well, of course, it's nonsense, because the vaccines don't give you immunity. They've never claimed that the vaccines give you immunity. So how can they then turn around and call it immunity waning or immune waning? It makes no sense. So, I mean, I was just appalled, and I was appalled that Andrew Marr didn't then push a little bit further and ask, you know, specifically, so why, how can you call it immunity waning when, you know, your own health ministers and prime minister have said that the vaccine doesn't protect you from getting the virus, and it doesn't protect you from or prevent you from passing it on. So that has nothing at all to do with immunity. But no, he didn't question her, because they don't. And then what did she go on to say? Well, you can guess. She went on to say, that's why they need their boosters. You know, they've crafted the narrative so that whatever they say, it goes according to their way of their plans, basically. So, I mean, it's ludicrous. Really, it's ludicrous. Comical, but tragic at the same time, because people are still buying this BS, basically.
Well, apparently there's been not enough take up of this booster jab, so we have to have. We were told, first of all, that we had a safe and effective vaccine, which lots of people took. And then we were told, oh, we're going to have double jabs, which immediately made me think, well, they're going to try and move into, well, you know, it doesn't really work, this thing, and they're going to try and, you know, maybe inject everybody every year like they did with the flu vaccine, which failed, which was proven to have failed by 2018. And now a booster jab too. So obviously with all these injections comes money rolling in to pay for all the, you know, the development of these various vaccines too. But you sent me, and this, you know, there's a lot of doctors out there and professors of various subjects, epidemiology, immunology, etc., who, and you sent me something about a guy called Professor Chris Exley, who's, you know, he seems to have been kind of basically ignored, not just ignored, but then suddenly bullied out of his university position because of what he believes.
Well, not just what he believes, but what his research is showing. Yes, and I was going to move on to that, because it kind of overlaps. This goes back to the older variety of so-called traditional vaccines. Professor Chris Exley is the world's leading expert on aluminium and the way aluminium interacts with biological systems. So his full title was Professor of Bio-Inorganic Chemistry at Keele University. And he headed a group, which a lab, a small lab group, which was focused on bio-inorganic chemistry. And, you know, Keele University supported and backed him up for coming up to 30 years, apparently, in this fairly controversial topic of aluminium, because aluminium is a metal which is used in a wide variety of products and processes. I think most people are familiar with a limited number of things which are potentially contain aluminium, such as tinned goods and tinned drinks and so on, and using tin foil, aluminium foil in cooking. And you know, some people are aware perhaps of deodorants and how they contain aluminium
The most important, surely, is that aluminium cooking pans, which were, you know, if you're stirring it around with a steel spoon or something, you're constantly chipping little bits of aluminium into the food that you're cooking.
Yeah, so, those sorts of things, I think most people are fairly aware of, and they can take measures to mitigate or limit their exposure and so on. But there's aluminium used in all kinds of processing, even in common table salt and, you know, various other things. And so, of course, all the time when you're challenging these consumer products and these manufacturing processes, you're running up against large corporations and large, business interests. And so, you know, it hasn't been easy for him, but Keele University, up until quite recently, was always very supportive and backed him in all of his research. And so he was producing groundbreaking research until, it seems, he began to focus on the one sector that you simply cannot discuss, and that is vaccines. And as soon as he wandered into that territory and began to do research into the aluminium adjuvants in vaccines, which are put there specifically to excite the immune system to create a response. Right, so as we discussed before, in the traditional vaccines, their method is to kind of introduce either a similar viral virus or an attenuated one or killed one. But in order to get the body to react to the introduction of that, these adjuvants are added to, you know, force the body to kickstart the body to react to that ingredient that has been injected into the body. Now, there have been no...
So hang on a second. So the idea is that your body detects the aluminium and thinks, that God, what on earth is that doing here? But doesn't just focus, or cells don't kind of try to... I don't know what they can do to aluminium. They can't destroy it. They might try and, you know, sort of transport it and get it out of the body. But that is supposed to have some kind of knock-on effect, where some of the reaction of your body and some of the cells then forget about the aluminium somehow, and then go on and start doing something to whatever else has been introduced, your body, namely the vaccine, you know, the actual thing that I mean, to me, that doesn't sound all that logical, really. But anyway,
I'm not an expert in vaccinology, and I can't really understand how it works. I don't know how they explain how it works in theory. But that is, I think, in very simple terms, the theory. And in fact, I do believe that. So, for example, in the flu jabs, they have flu jabs for different age groups. So for the older age groups, they have, and I don't know where the cutoff point for the age limit is, maybe 50, it may be 65, I don't know. But they get a different flu jab to younger cohorts. And I hope I'm not mistaken, but I believe I'm right. Those, the flu vaccines for older cohorts contain even greater concentrations of aluminium for the purpose, because there is this belief that older individuals have a weaker immune response and therefore need a greater kick from these adjuvants to kickstart their immune response. So his research was linking the buildup of aluminium in the body to neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, and of course, you know, the cases, exponential, it seems, growth in cases of autism. And he hit a brick wall. That is a no-go area. It is quite clear. It is a taboo. You must not talk about vaccines in any shape or form, it seems, not even the old-fashioned so-called traditional ones. From the beginning of the pandemic, basically, so-called pandemic, Keele University apparently shut down its laboratories, and everybody was instructed to work from home. So there's an article which I discovered in Research Professional News that was published on the 27th of March last year. Keele University shut down the university and told everybody to work from home. However, Dr. Exley's laboratory, where he works with his small number of colleagues, was very small, he argued. They all worked in their individual labs. I think he said in this specific article that there were only three of them in total, and that, you know, it was critical that they should carry on their research because of the funding that goes into these research programs, not to waste the funding, and also because of the nature of the work that they do. Working on cell lines, live cell lines, you cannot abandon them, cannot just put them in a cupboard. Yeah, so they've got to either go into deep freeze, which is what apparently they did. They froze these cell lines that they were researching on. But it seems from that day onward, he was basically being edged out. Funding to his department, funding to his group was withheld and even sent back. He received funding from Robert Kennedy, a grant in terms of the amount, it's not all that significant, but £15,000, which, or dollars, I can't remember which, But the government, the Keele universities, the top of the university turned down this donation and sent it back, even though it was completely above board and had been previously cleared as an acceptable donation. He's basically, the whole thing has been disbanded. According to the most recent article, the article from the Defender here, Children's Health Defense, the Defender article states that basically everything was disbanded by the 31st of August. Let me see, I think it was this year. Postscript here on the article. All research in the group will end on August the 31st, 2021, and a wonderful team of scientists will lose their job. So in this article, which it isn't the one that I sent you, but this is the one on the Defender, he goes into how funding changed and how the actual whole department was redirected to focus on something else entirely. So Dr. Exley's group, or his research group, was the bio-inorganic chemistry group. That was redirected in 2019. They had a makeover, and it became the School of Pharmacy and Bioengineering. And when I went onto their funding site on Keele University, they are now partnering and receiving funds for a number of bioengineering firms, as well as from the US's National Institute of Health, and also from the Wells Pharmacy, which is, I think, part of the Wellcome Trust. And, of course, not to be missed out, the now universally, spread throughout the globe in terms of donations.
To be worshipped, obviously.
Worshipped, yes, is the Gates Foundation. Who have donated to the university as well. So, it's mind-boggling that this sort of research, which is crucial to public health, one would assume and argue that, to really understand how aluminium, whether it's in food or water or, the air we breathe, or whether it's something that is being injected into us as a well-known neurotoxin, it really should be a matter of public research and understanding. And yet it's being shut down by these companies and organizations that are now wanting to focus in a new direction of a medical paradigm. And that is the direction of gene and cell-based therapy. Now, they call it therapy. I don't like to call it therapy because that sounds like something that is beneficial. And I don't think we can argue at this stage that it is. But it is basically gene and cell-based interventions. And it's a whole new paradigm. And there is a lot of evidence that pharmaceutical drugs are actually a market that's collapsing. I don't know if you're aware, but there's a difference between pharmaceutical drugs and what's known as biologics. Biologics is the category that vaccines come under. And there are two very different sectors for a pharma business. So pharmaceutical drugs are, you know, they're very expensive, very, very expensive to create new drugs. The R&D process of finding something that is going to be effective and, you know, can be marketed is laborious and expensive. And then there's many, many years of trials and testing and so on, which, you know, probably, I don't know because I haven't dug into it yet, but quite often are not worth it at the end. They have to junk it and start again. So the whole process is very laborious, very expensive. And eventually you get a product that you put out to market. But then there's different scenarios that unfold. One is that after a number of years, there are generic products that are developed, basically off the back of your, you know, your high profile so brand name product, let's say something like Viagra, you get spin-offs from it. So then the brand name product begins to lose value or market share. And then you also have a scenario where actually your product doesn't work so well on the global scale and eventually has to be pulled off the market. And so many, many hundreds of drugs are pulled off the market because they eventually are found to be more damaging than effective. And in fact, Pfizer has just recently had to pull one of its smoking cessation drugs out off the market, Shanrix or something like that. Pfizer have also just paid out recently the biggest compensation or fine in medical history, something like I can't remember whether it's 1.8 billion or 1.3 billion in fraud and malpractice for four drugs that were marketed by Pfizer, which they had to pay compensation for. So yeah, it's a very problematic business model. And of course, eventually those products run into patent expiry, and then, you know, they can no longer pay the sort of they can no longer charge the exorbitant fees that they required in order to compensate for their massive investment at the beginning. So that's pharma drugs as a failing business model. And I think there's a strong argument for that. So it seems to me that my theory now, my hypothesis is that the pharma industry is moving away from the pharma drug model towards biologics, which are much less rigorously monitored and managed.
Policed.
Because basically vaccine manufacturers have full liability for vaccines. It's the liability is shouldered by all national governments, or at least it is in the US and the UK, and I suspect Canada and Australia and so on. You cannot take a vaccine manufacturer to court and sue for damages. So there's a massive incentive to invest in biologics, and in this new cell and gene-based interventions. This is the model that they are going to pivot towards. It's already becoming evident because there are now more and more news articles that are focusing on these breakthrough treatments, new treatments that are gene-based or cell-based. And so, yeah, I think this is what the new medical model is going to be. And they're going to try and sell it as something that is more tailor-made, it's more individualized, it's more specific, it's less costly, it's innovative, and, you know, all the sort of glowing terms that they will use to market to doctors and clinical practitioners and to the public. Because the old model is no longer creating the enormous profits that they'd enjoyed, you know, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. That's my theory.
Okay, but before we close, you talked right at the start about this idea of asymmetric warfare. I think this is a term which is maybe, you know, amongst military circles, maybe they're on top of that, but most of the public have probably not even heard the term.
Basically, it's a type of warfare that's non-conventional. It doesn't involve necessarily the military in terms of, you know, warplanes and the Navy and soldiers on the land. In a way, it's a sort of guerrilla warfare, but it's maybe even more diverse than that, because it involves the economy, it involves the psychology, it involves social disruption. I mean, it can be any combination of these things to disrupt, to debilitate, to confuse, to damage. And so, yeah, I mean, it's conceivable that it's an attack on China. However, I see it as an attack on just the whole 20th century way of doing things. And they have a vision of a new way of doing business. The new way involves AI. It involves mass surveillance and data harvesting. It involves total control, information control and awareness. And it turns every individual into a commodity as well as a consumer. So, you know, it's hard to get our heads around because it's something we are not really familiar with at all, something that most of us have never lived with. But it's gradually, you know, we're seeing layers of it unfold, and the destruction of the NHS is part and parcel of it, because the model of the NHS in the future it's just not going to work as it used to do. So they've planned it all out. It's all pretty much in many of their policy documents, if people are inclined to read through and understand them. And you know, a lot of people who are connected with the government at the time, as has been evident with the current batch of kleptocrats in cabinet and Downing Street, they will profit from it. Because as in any new development of any industrial revolution or any type of introduction of a new system, those at the top, the oligarchs, will basically skim off all the deals at the top, so that, you know, they've got market dominance, and that's what's happening.
Okay, but I mean, for us as members of the public, how do we fight against an asymmetric war? Is it possible to fight back?
I don't know. Because I've never been in this situation. I don't think any of us have, unless they've lived in a country that has gone through massive change. Perhaps those who lived in previous, you know, Soviet states may have an inkling. But then again, how much of that was organic and how much of that was a deliberate, you know, push from outside, I don't know. I think really the only way the system will not be successful in being fully rolled out is if people simply refuse to comply. So, you know, not going to get your booster is not complying. You know, that's one way of not complying. Not taking your child, for God's sake, to be vaccinated is another way of not complying, because we have to maintain significant numbers of people who have not had the jab. You know, we are the control group, those of us who have not been jabbed. There is no other group, no other population group now, because they've unblinded the placebo groups. There is no way of knowing what the effect of these jabs will have on an individual or not, if there's nothing, no control group. And, you know, using cash all the time, as much as you can, use cash, insist on using cash. Do not be lulled into the convenience of just waving your phone around or your plastic. Make the effort, going into your bank, interacting with bank tellers, putting cash in, taking cash out, using cash, and writing to schools, heads of schools, and MPs, and saying that you will not vote for them at the school board meetings, to your MP, specifically saying you will not vote for them if they vote in favor of mandatory COVID passes or vaccines or any of this nonsense. They need to get the message, and I think they are beginning to get the message, because there are signs that even in the mainstream media, they're beginning to scratch a little bit at the surface of this monolithic narrative that is built on sand.
Okay, Catherine Gunn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.